Good morning. In the UK, in London, it's 7:30. And in New Zealand, what time is it, Dr. Ian Yeoman?
It's 8:33 p.m.
It's 8:33 p.m. We're a bit late starting. So my guest at this time, to accommodate my friend on the other side of the world, is Dr. Ian Yeoman. I'll let Ian do a full and fulsome introduction to himself. But this show is What Comes Next Live. And the time frame of what comes next varies for different people. And for Ian, it could be the next match for Sunderland FC, or it could be the distant future and what it means for tourism in New Zealand in a world where we ban air travel because of the climate crisis. Who knows? Ian will tell us a little bit about himself. A little bit from me is many, many years ago, the geek in me who was looking at Scottish tourism strategically from in the Cayman Islands, saw a website on which somebody was dumping white papers of ideas he was having. And I emailed him and he went, oh, it's really nice to hear from somebody. And Ian was at the time, I believe, pretty much the world's only tourism futurist. Life has moved on since then. So Dr. Ian Yeoman, welcome. Welcome. It's the first time we've spoken in quite a long time. Great to have you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what's on your mind.
Kia ora. Well, my name's Ian Yeoman. I am a futurist, or a tourism futurist, so I can talk about the future of tourism, but I can't talk about the future of medicine, the future of retail, or the future of brain surgery, because one of the things that I do, I have a good understanding of tourism and where it is and what its history is. And by understanding the complexity and the interrelationships, you can probably then delve into it to see where it, to see where it's going. So that's my work. It's just about the future of tourism, but it's about the structural changes in society and where they go. So that's what I do from a research perspective or consultancy perspective. But I'm an associate professor at Victoria University in Tourism Futures. So I do a lot of teaching. I have PhD students, but I travel around the world on holiday. I'm going to other universities and doing various things. So, but at the end of the day, I do what I love, and I have a great passion for writing. So I write about the future. So that's a little bit about me and the little things that you probably don't know about me. I'm New Zealand's number one Sunderland AFC fan. I think I'm the only one.
I'm a big fan of loyalty. I live in South London, which has London, depending on whether you claim Watford is in London or not, which is debatable, has something like 8 Premiership teams. Only one of them is south of the river. Right? And it's quite remarkable how many people who live in South London claim to be Chelsea, Arsenal, Tottenham, West Ham fans. And I just go, you're not serious about this. I assume you're from the northeast, from the accent, originally.
I am. I'm from the city of Sunderland, and Sunderland's a one football town or one football city, and it's one of those things. If I went back 40 years, and it's a representation of how society's changed. On a Saturday afternoon, my dad used to finish work at 12 o'clock, mm-hmm. and he would go to the football match like everybody, all males did, and my mother used to go to the hairdressers, and we'd meet up for 6 o'clock for tea. But that was the time when the northeast of England was fundamentally about two industries, which was coal mining and shipyards. Mm-hmm. It was a very male society. You know, if you left school, you could easily get a job as an apprentice in the shipyards or as an apprentice with the National Coal Board. But the northeast of England has completely changed. There are no shipyards. There are no coal mines. And the biggest employer now is Nissan car factory. So it's a very different world from 40 years ago. And that's a good thing to talk about tourism. We tend to be complacent whether tourism will grow or will be the same as the past. But we have changes in society. And like the northeast of England, what the future of tourism will be today may be different from what it is tomorrow, in terms of change. And when I talk about tourism, I talk about long-term things. Some things won't change. And the main reasons why people go on holiday in the terms of behaviours and the reasons for holiday, it's probably to search for culture, to relax, and to be with family and friends, they won't change. And the more busy society becomes, and the more busy your life becomes with more technology, the role of tourism becomes even more important, because it's a period of where you switch off and where you do things. And then, you know, one of the trends in society at the moment is about mental well-being and how we create mental well-being. And tourism right at the epicenter of that. It's an escape route. It's how we escape to do something else. So sorry, I've got a frog in my throat. So tourism has a good future in the terms of that. So I've always been very positive about what the future of tourism will be for a number of reasons. Hmm. There's a number of things that are out there, and I always talk to people. So if I was to say, what will be the two things that will change the future of tourism? Mm-hmm. Well, tourism's the two right core drivers. These are long-term trends. But, you know, the first one's always going to be the climate.
Right.
Because whatever the climate is, if you look at the IPCC scenarios, mm-hmm. that shapes the place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you've got disruptive weather patterns, you've got rising tides, you've got a hotter climate, they change the ecosystem. So that changes the product and the experience where you go. And all of that research is very well documented in the terms of what you do and how you go. And the other big slow burner in the terms of change that will come, so if you go 30 to 40 years out, there's no doubt about it will be demography. If you look at the aging populations and falling birth rates, they'll get to the point in the future where, you know, you just don't have enough people it's the relationship, those that are in work servicing the number that are out of work or not working, and the relationship change. So they're the two big long-term change that will, that will shape markets, because the attitudes and beliefs, for example, of somebody that's 20 is very much different from somebody that's 50 or 60, and what they do and how they behave and what they eat and what they do. So that's where the big shifts will go. Then the other big drivers of change that we'll see, I've just written a book on science fiction, so I always talk about the concept of technological singularity. So think of iRobot. It's basically the relationship with augmented reality, the metaverse, automation, all of these technological advancements we'll see. And when you get to the point around 2050, 2060, where human and robot become undistinguishable and what they are and where they're going. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, robotics and technology is very much it makes our life easier to a certain extent, but it changes how we engage with tourism and how we see it. It doesn't change what tourists do in the terms of relaxation, but it reshapes how we engage with them. You know, and the biggest classical example of that has been, you know, 40 years ago when I was, the 40 years ago, a visitor information site or a tourist eyesight was quite common. Yeah. And now they've virtually disappeared from across the world, because we don't use them. So again, that will have them. And the other big, then you've got to ask questions. Who will the future tourists be? Where will they come from? So again, if you're following that trend, you ask the question, where will the middle classes of the world be? Because it's wealth creation that shapes tourists in the terms of that. So and those are the obvious questions. We're talking about Southeast Asia. We're talking about Northern Asia in the terms of China. We're talking India. So we're talking those countries, but in the terms of emerging middle classes. But fundamentally, world tourism globally will still be dominated by Europe, because that's where the population epicenters are. Europe's still got all the cultural icons in the terms of doing things. So it's where you want to go and where you want to do.
So let me I want to pause because there's a lot of information throwing out, so I want to capture it. I'm just going to connect a couple of dots and ask for your thoughts. The first thing you talked about, which I think is a really important lesson for anybody looking into the future, is to study the past. You were very clear. You know, I actually do know a number of futurists, and some of them are generalists. So it depends upon what level of depth they go into. Choosing to really focus on tourism, the lens through which you look at the present and the past is often, because you love tourism, is looking at what does that mean, whether it's past history of human behavior or demography or industry or, you know, the industries of Sunderland or whatever. There's always that lens. So I just want to anchor for listeners on the podcast, that, you know, really get deep on the history of anything you're looking to predict the future of. So you then talked about, there's two areas, I'd want to just recap this, but there's two areas I want to kind of quasi challenge or just delve into. And you kind of talked about three reasons for why people have tourism, why they indulge in it. And one is, and I'm using my own language because it was something you said a few minutes ago, one about just slowing down and taking time for yourself and with other people. Slowing down and then being with other people and then culture and discovery of places and history, etc. And so the assumption with tourism is that we travel away from home for that. And the two current themes you said, you know, what are the two drivers? One is the climate change. And there is, you know, you're right. I mean, I've lived most of my adult life in the Cayman Islands, which is, you know, if we speak real talk, one of the areas within the Caribbean, which itself is in the hurricane belt, which is most likely to be impacted by a major hurricane. And I've seen one in my lifetime there. That actually means a really major storm every X number of decades. But a warning quite often. Right. And a warning is all it takes to stop people coming in the higher hurricane season. So there is that. And, you know, if you're from Kiribati, then you've got no country in 20 years. Right. Then the demography piece, you know, where people are living longer and the demographic shape is changing. So there aren't enough people to serve them. So there are two kind of thoughts popped into my head and I'd love your thoughts on them. And the first one is, and I think COVID force people to look at this. I mean, I live in the UK right now. I've lived around the world, but I'm in the UK right now. And the weather in the UK isn't brilliant. So people tend to travel and they conflate tourism with warmth, like needing to get warm. But actually, when they couldn't travel for the first couple of summers of the, or it was just a hassle, or getting back and be able to come to work, if you had a COVID test, you couldn't fly. People, you know, this, it's becoming more and more troublesome to fly. I mean, going back to 9/11, 21 years ago? Before then, it was just a breeze flying internationally, and then it just became much more difficult. But so many people just took time out to be with each other, to slow down, to relax, without traveling extensive amounts of distance. So, you know, that shape of tourism may change. And if you look at the, you know, but you're talking about, you know, I remember 20 odd years ago, I was a real geek for travel through airports. I used to travel a huge amount. And then I would go through an airport with a colleague or something and they'd go, no, we turn left here, we turn right here. I'd looked at the airport maps online before I went to a new airport. I knew my way around the airport before I even did it. So I'd actually, my travel started before I got there. So it's, what do we mean by travel for tourism? If the experiences are to slow down, be with each other, right, as two of the three core drivers, then sometimes it's just switching off the phones. I went on a trip with some, you know, people close to me last September. We just went 2 hours drive, and the agreement was anybody who came with us had to do no work at all and switch their emails off for a week. Right? One of the people, the sixth person that's going to come with us, said, I can't do that. I can't guarantee I can do that. Can I just log in a couple of hours a day? We said, no, you'll spoil the vibe. So they didn't come. The second one is around demography. And one of the things I've been focused a lot on in recent years is the third age, particularly driven by my friend Chip Connolly, who past guest on the podcast, writing the book Wisdom at Work. And his focus is on the workplace. And it's really the acceptable form of bias is ageism. And, you know, if you're 50 plus and you're going up for a job against somebody who's 20 or 25 or 35, your chances aren't good. People are getting irrelevant in the current workplace, more quickly. And yet a couple of weeks ago, I was at an event, which one can laugh about middle-aged men in Lycra, and, you know, it's called the midlife cyclist. But it was a bunch of men and women typically in their 50s. And the author and the panel were talking about how our generation are the crash test dummies of staying fit after 50. Because our parents, you know, your dad, my parents, they might have been, even if they were really sporty when they were younger, they probably stopped by their 30s, right? So their level of activity might be, you know, to be generic, a bit of golf, a bit of walking, whatever. The idea of staying fit into your 50s, 60s, 70s, I refereed a master's swimming meet, and there are people swimming up to their high 80s, faster than 99% of the population of any age could do. So I guess my challenge to your thing about demography is also, if you look at economics, nobody's going to be able to afford to retire. If the paradigm is you work at a job you might not love that much till you're 60, 65, now 67 and stretching in the UK, and then you retire and you do nothing other than look after the grandkids, then you die at 70, right? If the life expectancy of the average person in the quote unquote developed world, if once they're 50, is to have an active life well into their 90s. People don't have enough money to retire, so they're going to have to reshape what they do. And therefore, not only are you going to have not just, you know, the idea of multi-generational holidays that became a thing about in the last 20 years, then you're going to have four generations going on holiday. So how big are the houses and cottages and apartments you need for that? And then you're also thinking, well, you don't stop work at 50 or 60. You'll be working till you're, you know, I actually saw Kay Mannion on the front desk of a hotel in central London a few years ago in her 70s. Mm-hmm. She'd moved to London because she had children who'd moved to London, and she moved there as a healthcare refugee because she could use the universal healthcare for free in the UK. Whereas she got to an age where she wasn't eligible for workplace private medical insurance in the Cayman Islands. So she went, I'm not sick now, but I might be. And she's happily working on front desk to keep herself busy in the 70s. And to hear a Caymanian accent in West London, West Central London, was weird. So the two thoughts are, what if tourism, the two drivers are slowing down and being with each other, means we travel less? And just challenging your idea around demography, because we could just be stretching the envelope from adulthood being 18 to 60, to being 18 to 88.
Well, there's a lot. I could spend the next 10 hours talking about demography.
I seem to recall when we first met many years ago, we spent multiple hours in bars drinking pints doing that.
Yeah. And, you know, I could throw a spanner in the works. For example, if you look at the future of medicine and drug therapy. So, you know, basically, there's a certain point in time when you get old, you just get old, and it becomes difficult. So, for example, if you look at demography statistics, 90% of people over the age of 90 have Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And that's a big thing in society. But if we look in 10 years' time where drug therapy will be with Alzheimer's, you know, if you look at some of the emerging trends in the pilots, for example, Professor DiPino at Harvard Medical School, he's now been able to, in his research with Pfizer, for example, he's been able to reverse the aging process in mice. Mm-hmm. So in his laboratory, mice get younger. So imagine if that drug therapy goes on into 10 to 15 years, and there's no such thing as Alzheimer's. There's no such thing as Alzheimer's, and there's a cure for it. We can slow, you know, all of the drugs are about slowing the process down. Mm-hmm. It's all about telomere structure. So that's the wild card. Where you're going, what you're doing. So one of the points from a futures perspective is, you know, if you're a futurist and you're looking to trends in society where they're going, a piece of advice to many people is look to what are the patents that a company, patents, for example, companies are developing in medicine, in technology, because those patents will tell you something about directions. These are the weak signals that will be happening. So I think that was the cyber scene, but coming back to core demography, it's about the moment in time. So the World Economic Forum 20 years ago, did some very good work on the future of demography. And basically they were saying everybody at 65 retires. Blurred, you know, what is retirement? You've probably got 7 or 8 years of very good health till you get to 73, 74. Mm-hmm. And once you hit 73, 74, it's what we call dodgy health. It's downhill. The cancers are coming on. The Alzheimer's, the Parkinson's, that are coming on. So what we're seeing in society is people are trying to beat that curve. People are saying, you know, they've retired around 65, 67. They're then saying, I want to stay healthier and live longer. So this group of people, that baby boomer generation, which was driving this, are staying healthier to live longer. Mm-hmm. And also they get, and because they're getting a state pension, then what they're doing on that, they're doing all of the part-time, they're doing lots of part-time jobs. Mm-hmm. They're keeping fit. They're in clubs, social groups. They're driving all of the activities. They're driving all of volunteerism, across the world in terms of doing things. So it's a different generation from the generation prior to them in terms of doing things. So that was the generation that booked all of the cruise ship holidays, drove that market.
Yeah.
In the terms of doing, and to a certain extent, because we've got changes with immigration flows, that more elderly person has also been very innovative in the terms of part-time jobs, small businesses, they've also been doing a lot more support type of things. So there's a lot going on, you know, and that elderly person, for example, spends nearly three times as much time with their grandchildren than grandparents from 30 years ago, because they're just living longer, being healthier. But at the same time, you know, both parents are working now. It's opened lots of markets with grandparents taking grandchildren on holiday. So if you look at Disney, for example, you look at Disney theme parks, 20% of Disney's market is now grand travelers, you know, grandparents with grandchildren.
Wow.
In the terms of the day out. And because there's a lot less children about, they become more of a commodity. You know, we want to spend more time with them, because there's less of them. And they become the focus of the family. So again, that changes what we offer in the terms of the products, in the terms of the experiences. So there's a whole things, there's a whole lot that surrounds demography in the terms of how it shapes and what we do, in the terms of that. So that was the demography question. And relating to that was that question of distance. I think for tourism's always been about chilling out, relaxing, or the education, entertainment binary in the terms of culture. So for example, in the UK, we haven't been able to do the sun, sun and sea destination. We haven't been able to go. We just haven't been traveling. So what's happened in the UK, domestic tourism has seen a fundamental boom.
Yeah.
In the terms of what you can do. In UK tourism is very different from continental tourism because it's more about activities and doing things. Scotland is not Marbella or the south of France. It's an activity-based place because it rains a bit. But there's a lot more culture in terms of festivals around Edinburgh. There's the West Coast and the islands. So what we do is very different. But one of the things that's coming out of COVID-19 is, so for example, Airbnb last year sold more short lets in Cornwall than they did in London. And why? It was just a simple reason. We felt a lot more safer in a rural location than we did in an urban centre, because safety in 2021, because of COVID-19, was prominent. We wanted to cocoon ourselves and do that type of activity in the terms of doing things. So again, it's about procedures and where we'll go. So basically, if you're going to do intercontinental travel or foreign travel, the two questions are about accessibility, mm-hmm. cost, and convenience, and about doing that. So a number of people will switch off from that in the terms of things. So I've got a trip to Croatia in the middle of, in June, at beginning of June, but to get from New Zealand to Croatia, it's a bit of a pain. It's 3 to 4 connections, from where I live. Then there's all of the COVID-19 tests, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I get there, there's issues around insurance, you know, that I've got to think about how do I get back and all of that time. So it's about convenience. So I think you're quite right. I think around at the moment, the issues around safety, Ukraine, I think, you know, domestic tourism is seen very much more of a renaissance. Because it's local, it's controllable, it's more accessible, and to a certain extent, you know more about it. But without doubt, you know, it's not the end of tourism in the Mediterranean or Spain, because those destinations are seeing a bit of a boom at the moment, because as you come out of COVID-19 and where you go.
I think that's some really good stuff there. I'm just going to digest it long after we get off the call. The distance bit, I think that you're also talking about, I mean, one of the things I focus a lot on is the workplace and,
yeah.
I mean, I typically, my clients are typically, senior leaders looking for transformative change in their organizations.
Yeah.
It's about leadership, and it's leadership. And my phrase is leadership is about people, end of story. So it's always about understanding your people. What do they need? How do you, you know, one of the huge, you know, you and I are approximately similar ages. So, you know, we grew up in the UK.
Yeah, I've got hair. I've got hair.
Thank you, mate. I support a better football team. that's subjective, right? But we grew up with, you know, Thatcher in the 1980s and real massive shifts in industry and what work looked like. And you mentioned Sunderland's a great example. But if we look at that now, it's like when you've got those workplace shifts we talked about mind, you know, well-being. Actually, the phrase I heard from the people around that cycling event were leading a long and healthful life, which I think is a really interesting trend. And, you know, I'm just Gen X rather than baby boom, but those demographic, you know, generations are different. But yes, the idea of just, it's an expectation that we'll not just stretch the 73 wobbly health, but we'll live forever, basically. But the world of work, you know, the internet really kicked in about 1994, 95 when email became a thing, and then we got BlackBerries and all this kind of stuff. And there was this idea, almost this, and I'm a student of economics, there was this, you know, Keynes was saying 80 years ago that we would only work 3 or 4 hours a day because of efficiencies. Well, of course, what happened when we got email is we're on all the time, nonstop. And working from home for the people to whom it was brand new, unlike the likes of you and I have probably done it for 20-something years, it was like they ended up, I'm actually working longer hours, even though I'm not going to the office, right, because I'm never switching off. So the desire to, you know, when I grew up, holidays were very, very active. People wanted to get out and do a whole load of stuff, no matter what country they were in. And you know, there was the idea of like the Brits from this cold country going lying on the beach for 2 weeks and doing nothing. That will actually make a big comeback to me because of the reasons you're talking about, but for a different reason. It's just because it's all about relaxation. And I think people just need that switch off time so much more now. So there's a shift in what they're looking at. I guess I'm kind of rather than add anything more, I guess the one thought I really want to look at, and, you know, my home countries are twofold. One is Scotland and the other is Cayman. And you know, this is my recollection of the story, is the reason you got brought out of academia into Visit Scotland years ago was the chief executive at the time was an oil industry guy, and he went, who plans your future scenarios? Because the oil industry does that, right? Tourism doesn't. Philip Riddle, who actually beautifully, what did he do in retirement? I had lost touch with him, and then I was actually in the Edinburgh University graduation in 2019, I think, when one of my sons was graduating with his MA, and who was called up for his PhD?
Philip Riddle.
I thought, yeah. Fantastic, he went off and got a postgrad in his, I guess, late 60s. But then I look at the Cayman Islands, and I'm going, you know, low-lying island, highest point land, not very much, in a hurricane belt, very, very wealthy island, great opportunity to invest in the future, doing very little about renewable energy or sustainable living because everybody's wealthy. So why change? Why rock the boat? And if my Cayman audience listens to this, I'm going, call Dr. Ian Yeoman, hire him and his consulting guys, and have him start looking into his crystal ball for you. Because I really do think, you know, in business, you're always looking for opportunities and gaps. You talk about Disney. Disney will be deeply studying all of these things, and they can try and experiment in the now. I remember Disney many years ago, the Experience Economy by Pine and Gilmore is one of the books that drove my work in tourism, right? Because, yeah. And that's mostly about Disney. They'll be looking at that stuff. They're looking deeply into the future to see how they can get an edge, how they can do things better, how they can live their purpose of helping people have fun, etc. I'm simplifying. I guess apart from pitching you to every country in the world that should hire you, what are the two or three, I mean, let me just ask you this and then you can answer and then maybe wrap up with any closing thoughts for yourself. I'm just wondering, what are the two or three things that countries need to look at around tourism? Very broad, but if they're looking into the future beyond the next 1 or 2 years, which most of them really don't, what do they, you know, apart from recovery from COVID, which is the understandable focus right now, if they look 5 years hence, what are the things that destinations need to look at?
I think you need to say a number of things. I think you need to follow the principle of the Irish, which is, if anything can go wrong, what will go wrong? So I always say to people, think about what would be the circumstances or events or trends that would make your business or your tourism product or destination not be here in 10 years time. So what would cause collapse? And people then say COVID-19 or Ukraine or something like that. But what would cause you to go fundamentally out of business and why? Because if you can understand why you won't be here in 10 years time, you can probably make some sort of decisions before that occurs. And that's the role of leaders, of chief executives, to foresee and understand the complexities of where you're going. The next thing is, I think about the Cayman Islands, and I think I don't know the Caribbean that well. The nearest I've been to the Cayman Islands is Panama. But I always say, you know, I've done a lot of work in the Pacific, you know, Fiji, Vanuatu, Tahiti. But the thing with those destinations is, they don't have to be everything to everybody.
No.
Because, you know, there's, you know, global tourism has gone from 25 million in 1950 to 1.3 million in 2019. So tourism's diversified, and there's no such thing as the typical tourist. There's still main holidays, but there's the weekend tourist, the second stay. So it's a very diverse industry. So if you're the chief executive of the Cayman Islands, you just got to say, this is what we are in the terms of a product or an experience where we've got resilience and it's longer lasting. And this is the type of tourist in the core markets where we want to attract in what they will do. And looking at that, this is the core business. Then you ask the second question. If the tourist has been once, what would bring them back a second or a third time? Because it's easy to keep a tourist then create a new tourist in the terms of that. So it's understanding there's something around diversity and resilience in understanding that market in the terms of that. And you go back to the experience economy. I've always been a great believer in that in the terms of what you're doing. So the second third is, what would be, this is what you are.
Mm-hmm.
What aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Define what you're not. And if you understand what you're not, it's easy to deliver what you've got.
Mm-hmm.
Then with that as an intermediate question is, what could you be?
Yeah.
And what some of the, you know, think about a couple of wild cards and a couple of alternatives to do that. And the final thought is probably don't forecast the future, backcast the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what we want to be or where we want to be. And this is how we should see it shaping up. And if you said, this is where we were, what would be the steps you would take, you know, what would be the decisions we'd have to take in order to get there and how, in the terms of what it could be and where it goes?
Wow.
And the final thing is, I think it comes back to what you said about leadership. Mm. A leader can't do it by themselves. It's about the team that's around them.
Totally. So I'm going to actually repeat what you said. If anything could go wrong, what will go wrong? What could cause collapse? So that's all about resilience.
Yeah, it is.
In the first instance, and I've been writing a fair bit about resilience in Taleb's book, Anti-Fragile, for example. Mm-hmm. Because being anti-fragile is a level beyond resilience. It's being able to take advantage of times of change. Then you talk about this area of focus. You don't have to be everything. And then the what would bring them back, it's, you know, it's easier to retain a customer than not. Now, a quick thought on that is Vincent van der Poel Wallace, who was the head of the Caribbean Tourism Organization for years, his stump speech is basically that the Caribbean is considered by Americans, for right or wrong, as one entity rather than about 30 distinct nations and destinations. But the joy of that is they'll keep coming back. And as long as they get a good experience in one island, they'll keep coming back to that island or another one. What aren't you? What could you be? My two thoughts are coming from listening to you are every question you're asking, while through the lens of looking into the future of tourism, are totally relevant to every business in every industry and into the leadership challenges. And when you got into, and one more thing, and you were different questions to ask, this is conventionally done by businesses looking at themselves or by with facilitation and workshops and all this kind of thing. The really smart thing is to find somebody who spends their life studying this in your industry. And if it happens to be tourism, that would be somebody like yourself, and bring in somebody to ask and answer those questions. And there we get back to the nice way to bring my last thought is that when you wrote a scenario for the Scottish government of saying 50% growth by, and it was like 10, 15 years in the future, some politician read it and went, oh, that's policy. To which he was going, it's a scenario. It's a discussion piece. But it became government policy, which is fascinating. So recognize that scenarios are there for you to explore in different directions before you land on something. So every lesson you're saying from your deep experience around looking into the future of tourism are totally applicable to every single industry. So that's it's a masterclass on looking into the future. So thank you.
That's okay. And I haven't mentioned Sunderland that much either.
Well, you know, you might win something in the next few decades. But there is a lot to be said for loyalty to the same club. I'm a Hibs fan, so you know, we'd have won the Ogmore trophy, but you know, we're equally small and but I'm not a glory hunter, so
Now that brings me back. Was it Mercer who, that era when they're trying to amalgamate the two clubs, it was just going to be a non-starter?
Yeah, it was a hundred year plus of deep history. But yes, we can't really get into a football chat now. We might lose our audience's interest. But if anybody wants to talk about Sunderland, they can talk to Dr. Ian Yeoman. He's the leading fan in New Zealand of the Sunderland AFC. And and I'm probably the only Hibs fan in my little town south of London. So
that's okay.
Anyway, it's been an absolute pleasure. And when you ever make it back. If you're passing through London, I will make a pilgrimage to wherever you're sitting and we'll have a couple of pints and we'll solve all the problems of the future.
That's okay. That sounds good.
Many thanks, Ian.
Take care.
Enjoy the rest of your evening. Cheers.
I will. Good night.